Human decency is not derived from religion, it precedes it.
The religion of one age is the literary entertainment of the next.
The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction.
Exceptional claims demand exceptional evidence.
Welcome to the podcast of Leaders in Free Thought. This is where Seth and I get together and discuss issues of importance to atheists, skeptics, free thinkers, and others who base their lives around reason. We bring you news, interviews, and thoughtful discussion on topics of importance to people in the free thought community.
I'm Seth.
And I'm Jeff, and you're listening to the Leaders in Free Thought.
So what's happening, Jeff?
What's happening, Seth?
Not much. I'm here in my own room recording a podcast.
That seems like the place to do it.
So here we have the second episode of our Fort Collins Skeptic Camp adventures. How would you describe this episode?
Well, at Skeptic Camp, we got a great opportunity to hook up with a bunch of different people for interviews. And these are some of the highlights. Obviously, the Mark Edward one broke itself off from the rest of them. But we got to talk to Mike Vincent, who was talking about promoting science to non-scientists. Norman Schultz. And we got to talk to Chama Wren, who had a speech called The Numbers Game, which... You attended that. I actually missed it. I believe my speech was around the same time. What was that about?
He had a strange title for it. He called it The Numbers Game, and he did start off with kind of like a statistics problem.
The Monty Hall problem?
Yes, the Monty Hall problem.
You can't do a lesson in statistics without the Monty Hall problem.
But then he goes into kind of like mind tricks, like mind games, ways that your perception can kind of trick you. And it was actually pretty interesting because I had read of the Monty Hall problem in a book I have called The Drunkard's Walk, which I highly recommend to all of you. But I hadn't really been exposed to anything else that he talked about. It had a lot to do with probably psychology and cognitive science.
Yeah, it seemed from some of the tape I saw that he was talking a little bit about perceptive issues, maybe something along the ideas of our consciousness being constructive, which I thought was really interesting. He explained sort of how he feels about what an illusion is, how it affects us, which is really important to skeptics because one of the, in my mind, the major features of a skeptic is someone who realizes how easily our senses and our minds can be fooled. You know, and specifically that's what science does, is comes up with ways for us not to have that issue, right? So
Adam Carolla talks about this, you might remember, or he mentioned it recently in his podcast about how if you watch like an action movie on mute and you don't hear those those fake punching sound effects, it'll be completely obvious to you that the punch is like a foot away from the face.
When it connects,
you know, and then when you hear that sound effect while the arm is moving toward the face, then your brain just kind of fills in the gaps.
Yeah, definitely. I don't know if you've ever seen a film where they haven't done the Foley on it yet, right? Where it's got the dialogue and it's got, you know, the actors are all there, it's the visuals, but no one's done the Foley. It's almost silly. Like, you watch it and you don't realize that, like, you know, a guy walking across the room and opening a door is like four noises. You know, it's him walking, it's the door creaking, the floor creaking, and, you know, the door actually swinging open. And it ends up looking so flat and deadpan if you don't have that. And it's interesting how our minds throw that all together, because obviously the Foley is done miles away in a studio by sound engineers who had nothing to do with the initial filming. They weren't even in the room.
Did you ever watch Reading Rainbow as a kid?
No, I missed LeVar it. That was Burton? The one with Jordy. Yeah, right. Yeah.
You missed that? Oh, that was the best.
I did. Oh, but I love Jordy.
But I remember they had an episode about Foley artists, and that was the first time I knew what the hell a Foley artist was. And then they had some...
It's not an everyday term.
Yeah. But then they had some footage of when someone would jump off a bridge into some water, they would have like a melon and like a bucket of water, and they would drop that in.
Yeah, yeah.
And when there were kissing scenes... Mm-hmm. They would just like kiss their own hands or something and record that. And it was just kind of strange because I was just thinking, well, why don't you just, it just made me realize that most of the sounds in movies are probably synthetic or artificial, not the genuine sounds,
yeah,
you know, that you hear, because they don't have boom mics there all the time recording everything.
I remember hearing this great interview with a director named Ed Burns. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he mm-hmm. was talking about overdubbing and the idea that if you got two actors on a street, most of the time you can't hear them. So they act out the scene, then they pull out all the audio, the actors do the lines again in a sound studio, and then they add the traffic sounds back in. And he was basically talking about how he'd completely fallen out of love with that, because it's the silliest idea that to get the traffic sounds to go away, you record them, then add the traffic sounds back in.
That does sound pretty absurd.
It was a really interesting thought process, because you don't think of it that way. You know, they're trying to get the best sound. But if you watch movies, you'll see it sometimes where, like, you're listening to the dialogue and then there's all of a sudden this cut where it's like a little clearer, a little quieter. The actor's tone changes just a little bit for no reason at all.
Well, you've just ruined all traffic scenes for me.
Oh.
So
that's okay. So you can't watch Cars again.
But back to our podcast. The first person you'll hear from today is Mike Vincent, and we'll play a little clip of his talk, which you can also get on YouTube. And afterwards, I caught up with him in the student center and had a little chat with him. So here's Mike.
The politics of science today is just crazy. You know, it's very partisan. It seems that it's more about which party you're affiliated with than who's supporting correct science. The funding bills, right now with the budget the way it is, they're slashing things left and right. One of the more recent budgets that I was able to come across was slashing $1 billion from the National Institutes of Health, $750 million from the CDC. They've had massive cuts to NASA, the National Science Foundation, EPA, I mean, just everywhere you look, it's just cut, 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 cut. On top of that, you've got these politicians that are just pushing climate change denial. Hey, it's snowing outside. Global warming isn't real. I don't buy that. You know, and it's just, it really just throws a wrench into the works of the hard work of real scientists. And then you have folks like Don McElroy, who was the superintendent of the Texas Board of Education, who, you know, in one of his, you know, getting up on the pulpit and yelling at people, was actually saying someone needs to stand up to these experts. He was talking about academic freedom, what they call academic freedom bills, trying to promote creation science, intelligent design, whatever you want to call it, in the classrooms. Brings us to education. Again, teachers are being laid off left and right. And then on top of that, here's a statistic I came across that was published in Science. 60% of U.S. high school biology teachers are not advocates either way of evolutionary biology or non-scientific alternatives. So basically, they're kind of like, all right, here's science. And they just try and brush over the topic completely because they're either not supportive of it in the first place, or they're terrified of hate mail and the phone calls and the headaches that it can cause them to have some kid go home, say, hey, we learned about evolution in school today. And the parents light their torches and get their pitchforks. My solution, I like this. Slap this in every textbook. Someday someone will clone a dinosaur. it says it right there. And what's funny is, while this isn't exactly what's happening, it's pretty close. It's actually, you know, science is really cool today. You know, so how do we excite people about science? You know, how do we, you know, everyone in here probably has some area of science that they find interesting. I got my degree in zoology. I tend to be partial to the biological sciences, evolution. You know, I've gotten interested in science education. What are you passionate about? You know, what areas interest you?
More and more, I've been just getting frustrated with the lack of science literacy, just in the public at large. Where you turn around, there's people peddling crap to people, and no one really seems to question it. You know, yeah. So I've been really trying to figure out where can we begin to start trying to teach science literacy to people. And I chose to talk about promoting science to non-scientists.
Yeah, and you mentioned Dr. Oz, who I think he has his own show, right? But he also frequents Oprah Winfrey. you know, he's got right. the Oprah blessing, and that's a huge megaphone.
Oh, it's a huge soapbox for someone, and he does. He's got his own show, and in the mornings, I just happen to watch the channel that he's on later in the day, so every morning I see what he's going to be peddling that afternoon, you know, while I'm eating my breakfast. And, you know, again, once every 2 weeks, once a week, somewhere in that neighborhood, he seems to be talking about something that's maybe actual medicine. And then the rest of the time he's talking about vitamin drinks and, you know, the latest fads for this or that and weight loss and supplements and whatever. I think I've seen him a couple with acupuncture.
So you had a list of kind of, I guess, it wasn't really a list. It was just kind of like a picture collage
right.
of different people who kind of helped, like, through the last century, I suppose, promote science and science literacy. Like, what are some examples of those people?
Oh, well, you know, like, I know I included in the list, you know, Einstein was on there, Hawking, you know, as far as like real hard physicists for both of them. Hawking, you know, like I said in my talk, typically if you ask a lot people involved in physics, they won't necessarily list Hawking as a terribly, you know, groundbreaking physicist. But if you ask any person on the street, name a physicist other than Einstein, it's Hawking. You know, yeah. Most people know Stephen Hawking.
Exactly.
And so he's done a great deal for just making this really crazy astrophysics attainable to people. You can sit down and read A Brief History of Time, and it might be a little over your head, but it's mostly in language that you and I can understand.
Mm-hmm. I really like, I'm a big fan of Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Love him.
Yeah, and I think he's really exceptional when it comes to kind of, because he's an astrophysicist, and he does a really great job of kind of breaking that really, really complex stuff down into like bite-sized chunks, and he's very charismatic, and he goes on a lot of programs. I see him a lot on TV and radio and
yeah, no doubt.
But it seems like for every Neil deGrasse Tyson, you know, there's going to be like 100 or 1,000 or more quacks or pseudoscientists, and they're peddling whatever, and it's usually for profit, you know,
right.
Something like that.
Well, you know, I think that goes back to, you know, the reason why I feel like scientific literacy is so important. As people begin to understand, as the population as a whole starts saying, oh, well, vaccines do work, they'll start shoving Jenny McCarthy off into a corner because they'll say, you're insane. Or they'll say, oh, Dr. Oz, well, tell us about real medicine, but we're tired of hearing about these, you know, the latest, greatest fruit smoothies, mm-hmm. you know, and what magical powers it must have.
So what are some things that people like you and I can do who don't have this, we don't have like a real audience, we're not extremely extroverted, or we're not extremely charismatic, and we're normal people.
Well, you know, a lot of it is real simple things. You know, most people don't have a job working for PBS hosting a Nova. Unfortunately, we just don't. Most people work in offices, and they just deal with everyday schmucks. And you and I are everyday schmucks. And so talk to people, you know, like if it's a matter of posting cool science news that interests you up on the outside of your cubicle, or, you know, just trying to talk to people about things other than just politics.
Do you think if like, say you're at work or you're in maybe like a public place, and then people start having a conversation about, you overhear, you eavesdrop.
Sure.
Someone saying, yeah, vaccines cause autism, you know, or, and that's why I'm not going to get my child vaccinated. Do you think it should be incumbent upon us to kind of go into that conversation and be like, hey, no, look, you got it wrong. Or should we just mind our own business?
One, you know, the autism argument specifically, you know, I feel like that one is such a, you know, important public health issue. That
could be life-threatening.
You know, it is life-threatening. There have been people dying because their children haven't been getting off. They haven't been vaccinating their children. And so, you know, that one specifically, I actually probably would really try and say, hey, are you really sure? Are you sure you got the facts on that one straight? No one really responds well to just being like beating them over the head with a textbook until they cry uncle. No one's going to respond to that. But if you can articulate a few sound, solid arguments to say, well, no, vaccines actually do work. All of the research that has been published regarding it causing autism are crock. They've been discredited, they've been refuted, they've been retracted, you know, and the ones that haven't are just crap.
What did you think of Mike?
I really liked his speech. I enjoyed hearing him talk about that kind of stuff. And then afterwards, I actually ended up missing that interview. But he talked about some pretty interesting stuff. I've heard statistics like this before, but for 60% of biology professors or biology teachers to not be an advocate either way on the evolution question, it's one of those things where now you're thinking about if you were a carpenter, but you were sort of agnostic to the view of whether or not certain kinds of nails went in certain places, yeah. You know, you're a framer and you're agnostic to how walls should be put together. It almost seems like you should be, you know, trucking off of your job. You know, how do you do that?
Yeah. Well, I certainly know, you know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to be like an elementary science teacher.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, where I grew up, we had people who had college degrees in drama teaching chemistry.
Yeah.
We had people who just got like athletic scholarships and studied exercise science. They were teaching history.
Bunch of communication majors.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure we even had like a handful of teachers who didn't even have any kind of college degree, at least where I grew up. So you don't have to be an evolutionary biologist to be teaching evolution, certainly.
There was a program back in California where I grew up, and I think it was called 20 to 1, something along those lines. And essentially what the state did was went out and hired anyone who wanted to be a teacher. And the idea was to get the ratio of students to teachers down to 20 to 1. That was the big push. But you really didn't need to have any background in education, any training in it, anything along those lines. And what's more, you really didn't need a background in whatever you were going to teach. And it's not like you need to be brilliant to teach fifth grade science class. But if you're going to teach biology, you should understand biology. And I know there are exceptions to every rule, but I have trouble believing that there are 60% of science teachers out there who truly understand the material and yet haven't formed some kind of opinion on it, you know?
Certainly.
I know you got to talk to him about some of your favorite science promoters. You got any others that you're a big fan of?
Well, I don't remember if Richard Dawkins was on his collage, but like obviously he's an atheist firebrand.
Mm-hmm.
But So The God Delusion was the first of his books that I really picked up. While I was reading it, I certainly developed a larger appreciation for science, and it made me want to go read his other works and delve more into science. And actually, I think that reading his book, although it was mostly about religion and why religion is false, actually, I think if I'd never picked up The God Delusion, I wouldn't be going to graduate school right now. But and after I read that book, He just filled me with such a love of science that was, I think it was kind of already there, but it just hadn't been brought to the surface.
A lot of his early books too, like The Selfish Gene or something to that effect. Not as atheist as people kind of expect from him. It really is just a very, very good science book.
Well, you mentioned Richard Feynman before we began recording.
Yeah, definitely. Because you guys both come up with physicists, and I was surprised from two science guys that he didn't come up, because the science community has a huge collective hard-on for Feynman. And if you get a chance to grab a YouTube video of Feynman, everyone should see some of his stuff. Oh, recommendation. Go look on Google Images. It's one of the first images. In fact, it might be on his wiki page. But find the picture of him when he was working at Los Alamos, when he was working on the nuclear project. his face is so shockingly untrustworthy. Like, he looks like the precursor to a supervillain or someone who might try and rob a bank with plutonium or something to that effect. It's cartoonishly funny. But yeah, if you get a chance, go check that out. So who do we have next?
Next up, we have a Mr. Norman Schultz. Again, we're going to play you a little bit of his talk and then my interview with him.
I'm going to give two reasons to reject cultural relativism, and I'm going to kind of cut to the end. Cultural relativism as a moral idea is unique in philosophy because in philosophy it has almost zero support. Most philosophies have some crazy person that likes them, even, no matter how silly they are. Cultural relativism is kind of unique in that, as far as I know, nobody that studies ethics likes them. I've never met or heard of anyone. So the first reason I'm going to give everybody here to reject cultural relativism is because I think it's lazy. To accept the idea that morality is just convention or is just collective opinion is to give up on the project of trying to find a rational basis and just have the knee-jerk reaction of, well, this is all it is. And so I think that it's giving up before one starts. But the second reason I think is a better reason, it simply does not work as a system. It is wildly implausible and irrational. For three reasons, I could give more than three reasons. I could spend another 2 hours on this if I really wanted to, and at that point you would see that it would be completely destroyed and obliterated and be tired of me. But I can give you three reasons. The first reason is that most people accept cultural relativism based on a fallacious argument. And the argument goes something like this. You look at other cultures, you see that they make different moral judgments, and from that you directly conclude that morality is not the kind of thing that is amenable to there being a right answer to. And this logic is exactly the same as the following logic. People work on a math problem and they all get different answers, therefore you conclude there is no correct answer to that math problem. That logic is obviously flawed, and so philosophers regard most people's argument for cultural relativism as being actually obviously flawed. Second reason, the basic evidence for cultural relativism is the observation that cultures have different moral views. They make different moral judgments. And that's true, but it's actually superficially true. Because if you look more closely at what civilizations do, you find that they actually have very similar values. What makes the differences in their moral judgments are that they differ in worldviews in other ways, such as they have different factual beliefs. So if one culture believes that when you die you're going to be accountable for your sins, well, then they have a different moral viewpoint about the point value of certain kinds of activities. If another culture believes, well, when you die, that's a reset button, and you just become part of life, then they have a different point value, and so on. Also, the circumstances that people live in. So for example, the Eskimos, they live in a their lifestyle does not afford them easy access to contraception or abortion. So when they have too many babies, they have to kill their babies. Well, if that happened in this culture, the woman would go to jail for a very long time. But they don't have a whole lot of other options. So it looks like a difference in moral judgments, but in reality, it's just a difference of circumstances. Okay? So the basic argument for cultural relativism, evidence for it rather, doesn't actually look true. And finally, this is for liberals. The liberal likes cultural relativism because they believe that it supports a tolerant worldview, and it actually doesn't. And the reason for this is because tolerance, the idea of not accepting, but tolerating other people when their views differ than yours, that can only be a universal moral rule. And that is exactly what cultural relativism says doesn't exist. There are no universal moral rules. So, by the way a cultural relative view would judge tolerance is the following. It would say, if you happen to live in a tolerant culture, then be tolerant. If you happen to live in an intolerant culture, then it's your moral obligation to be intolerant. And so it has no net effect. So I could give more reasons why cultural relativism is actually patently idiotic, but it's not something most people would realize. So once you look into these things, you see that it can't work. And that's why, again, no philosophically trained ethicist, as far as I am, favor cultural relativism.
Norman Schultz. I teach introductory philosophy courses. I frequently teach ethics. I teach for Metro State College of Denver. I also teach for Red Rocks Community College.
So your talk was about
the gains and perils
of secular morality. Right. Yeah. Okay. And you touched a little bit on cultural relativism, or at least I kind of got the tail end of cultural relativism.
Right.
What is cultural relativism?
Cultural relativism is the view that morality is not genuine, it's not real. Morality is just convention, similar to like rules of etiquette, that it's based on people's cultural upbringing, views, and there's no further truth behind it. That's all it is. And it's a view that people that study ethics don't find very plausible because of some central problems with that as an ideal.
Can you, is there any, like obviously morality, ethics, things like that, mm-hmm. it's, to me anyways, it's very complex and it's difficult to understand, but is there a way you can give in like a minute or two of why you think cultural relativism fails?
Sure. It's actually really easy. Two big reasons. One is that to suggest that, you know, the basic idea of cultural relativism is to suggest that there is no real truth to ethics. There's just what people think. And the reason that people use to support that is that when they observe people's moral judgments and their moral behavior, they find that there are differences from one culture to the next. And the problem is that suggests that because there are differences between the way people think, there is no truth to that particular matter. And that argument is not plausible. Just because people differ about something does not mean that that subject is inherently lacking in true or falsity. And secondly, the idea that cultural relativism is, there is no further foundation, it leads to some absurd conclusions. Leads to the conclusion that in order for someone to, say, conduct moral reform, they are automatically behaving immorally because they're acting against their own culture. And that seems completely wrong. We laud people that reform cultures. We view them as visionaries, and we're grateful for their, you know, sacrifices. As well as I just simply view it as a way of giving up. It's a very lazy way of looking at morality. It means that you haven't put a lot of effort in trying to figure it out, so you just make a rather passing comment of, oh, it's just relative, it doesn't matter.
I think in your talk you claim that the secular individual should care about, I guess, moral theory mm-hmm. and ethics, and they should try to intellectually defend mm-hmm. what they believe. Mm-hmm. I think I am like a lot of other people. I don't have a big moral background. I don't have a big philosophy background.
Right.
I kind of believe what is right. What I think is right is kind of like what I believe to be right.
Sure.
And what I think is wrong is what I believe to be wrong. And I don't spend a lot of mental energy.
Sure.
Trying to be intellectually consistent.
Sure.
Or spend any time creating defensible arguments for why right. I believe what is right. So right. why should I care about secular morality?
Good.
Why should I care about things like ethics?
Yeah, that's a great question. And what I'm arguing is that, you know, if you are a person that has become secular, as in you've rejected religion either outright like an atheist or tentatively like an agnostic, whatever, then you've done so because you held beliefs and you thought, well, these beliefs are important. They should have evidence to them. They should be rationally supportable. You saw that they weren't, so you abandoned them. And I would say, well, why are moral beliefs any different? Moral beliefs are actually quite important, right? We judge what people do. They underpin our laws. We put people in jail, and in this country, we even execute people based on moral principles. So why is it somehow different that moral principles don't require rational justification, but religious beliefs do? So I think that they do require a rational justification. A religious person, if you ask them where they get their morals from, they have a pretty easy, quick answer. I don't think that answer works out very well, but they have an answer. I think if you ask a secular individual, odds are good that they're not going to have an answer at all. And so I just think that that's a problem. Also, I would say that there's a PR problem, you know, with the atheist or secular community. There are a lot of people that think that if you're atheist, then that means that you don't have a moral foundation. And I think that it would be better if the atheist or skeptic community had a better association with certain moral ideas than the belief that, well, they don't have any morals. So I think it'd be worthwhile in both ways.
Several years ago, I took Intro to Philosophy.
Right.
And in the course of that class, I think it was Kant, right, that developed the theory of utilitarianism. Was it Kant?
No.
Or was it someone else?
Yeah, that's Jeremy Bentham, John Stuart Mill.
Oh, okay.
Kant. You probably learned the categorical imperative.
Oh, okay. Well, I can't. It's been a while.
Does that sound familiar?
But for some reason, I remember walking out one day and thinking, I'm a utilitarian.
Or okay.
I want to be a utilitarian. And I think that's the best way to live. I guess a short summary would be do what is best for all mankind or something
right.
like that. You could probably articulate it better than
well,
that.
Well, yeah, you can't just say what's best because then you have to answer, well, what is best? And that's kind of the whole game. So utilitarians believe that what is right is what is the action that leads to the greatest amount of happiness or pleasure or something like that.
Yeah.
And look, utilitarianism is a secular moral system. It's not ridiculous. You can support it. There are a fair number of utilitarians in the ethics community. So that's an answer. I personally don't think it's a good answer.
In your talk, you kind of outline briefly why you think it's false or why you think
right.
it fails. And
right.
could you explain why you think it fails?
Well, I think that utilitarianism, in that it focuses on consequences, ultimately what the judge of what is right or wrong is the effect your action has. That sounds good at first, but the problem with it is that suggests that the ends justifies the means. However you achieve increasing the amount of happiness is not of central importance, and therefore morality is not there. Morality is in the end result. And that leads to rationally supporting policies that could cause someone to be sacrificed for the good of others without their permission, or cause just a general outlook that makes you more interested in results and less interested in respecting a person's rights or freedoms or other things. And I think that ultimately utilitarianism has a problem in that it's, if you really look at it, it's very difficult to follow. It asks every person to think about the impact of their action in the bigger picture constantly. And I think most of us think that, you know, when I go to a coffee shop and buy a cup of coffee, I spend, you know, more money than I need to, that it's not morally wrong for me to do that. But a utilitarian might say, well, you could have given that $3.50 to a charity and helped someone, and you kind of did morally the wrong thing. And you extrapolate that to all the things you do, and it looks like it's kind of impractical to actually live by that view. And mm-hmm. you know, and what I'm trying to convince people of is, if you're secular and you recognize that a belief you hold doesn't actually work, well, that's a good reason to try to fix it.
So the moral theory that you subscribe to is, I think you called it the social contract. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, and that's an ambiguous name because usually the term social contract refers to theories of politics. The clearest name is contractualism. And that kind of centers more on the idea of morality being like a system of politics in that it's a social contract.
So why do you find that compelling?
I think the two big reasons why I find it compelling is, one, it is less demanding than utilitarianism. It basically suggests that my moral obligations are, for the most part, to leave other people in peace, to allow them the freedom to pursue their self-interest. It's not my job to make sure that they're happy. It's my job to make sure that they have the room to pursue happiness on their own. For utilitarian, it seems that it's, you know, everybody's job to try to just make everybody happier. And under social contract, that's not my responsibility. So it to me, it emphasizes a system of freedom and responsibility more than utilitarianism does. And I think secondly, it just sounds more plausible in that it tells a story of the way morality is real. Social contract suggests that morality is only real because people view it as real. They collectively buy the idea. Utilitarianism has had some problems in that area because it's suggested that what is right is that which benefits, in terms of happiness, the greater public, and suggests that you're just morally obligated to do that whether you like it or not. For under social contract, there's a real reason for me to, and therefore a motivation for me to be moral, because it makes for a society that I get a lot of benefit out of. I wouldn't want to live without a society. It would be a rough life. So it makes better sense to me, and it also convinces me there's something in it for me to be moral. It gives me a more of a reason to be a moral person, I think.
At the same time, I think you gave a couple of, I think at least one example of where that kind of theory may be a little hard to swallow.
Yeah, the basic, and this is in the standard in the literature, that in that contractualism suggests that morality only exists by agreement, and that is what makes us have obligations, is the fact that we live amongst other people that also feel obligations. One of the obvious problems is, well, what about a being that is not at the level of maturity or intellectual capacity to even implicitly agree to control their behavior? Animals are the first example. You can't go up to an animal and talk to it and say, look, let's make a deal. But you also can't do that with an infant. And you can't do that with someone that is severely mentally handicapped. And so notoriously, contractualism has had a hard time addressing what is the moral situation with animals, infants, and the mentally handicapped. Ultimately, I think that the system can overcome those problems by means of indirect moral obligations. So it might not, according to the theory, make sense for someone to have a direct moral obligation to a being that doesn't share that obligation back to them. But there can be other good reasons to have a sense of moral obligation, say, to the parents or to the greater society to protect infants, etc. Even though it becomes more complicated and initially sounds ugly, with some work, I think it can be resolved. It's just, you know, it's one of those things that the theory has a difficult time with.
All right. Well, Mr. Schultz, thank you for speaking with me today.
My pleasure.
But what did you think of Norman Schultz?
He was definitely interesting. I liked his discussion of cultural relativism, because there is a fair amount of cultural relativism. There's a lot of people who say, well, you can't judge.
You can't judge.
That doesn't really make
female
it
circumcision.
Okay.
Can't judge.
Exactly.
It's their way.
Although I kind of want my foreskin back, goddammit. I was not consulted on that.
Do you have any kind of philosophy background?
No, not at all. I've taken a few philosophy classes. I have
a few. That's quite a few more than me.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that intro to two or three different types of philosophy really qualifies me to discuss things. I do have an odd book collection in the sense that there are a few philosophers in there just for the fun of it. But nowhere near, I mean, we have a friend who is working on his graduate work in philosophy, and nowhere near that kind of real understanding of things. In fact, he constantly corrects me on my perceptions about what is and isn't going on with any given philosopher.
Are we talking about Kai here?
We are talking about Kai here.
So he, you mentioned that he claims to be a consequentialist, and he says...
He also claims that I'm a consequentialist.
Yeah, you're a consequentialist. What is that? Do you know what that means?
As I understand it, and I'm going to blow this, and Kai's going to yell at me. As I understand it, what I said to him essentially was, almost anything could be justified given a specific set of circumstances. And that's where I think you get to things like the Eskimos with the killing of the children and wars being debatably okay, you know, self-defense type things, is if you give the correct set of circumstances, you can probably justify almost anything. And he said that that makes me a consequentialist.
All right, so our last guest on the podcast is Mr. Chalmer Wren. So we already talked a little bit about what he did at the beginning of the podcast.
Yeah, Chalmer Wren did some interesting stuff on illusions, perceptions, things along those lines. And one of the things I want to point out to our audience is that some of his talk does, maybe not necessitate, but it does lead to some visual aids. We'll have the video on the website if you want to see specifically what he is and isn't talking about, what visual aids he did use. So,
leadersinfreethought.wordpress.com.
See, I immediately remembered that. It's such a catchy, it's such a catchy blog name.
Without further ado, here's Chalmer Wren.
So now I'm going to talk a little bit about self-perception and tactile illusions. And just because I like to collect these examples of times when we sort of deceive ourselves. And these are just a few interesting ones I've come across recently. I wanted to share them with you guys. So first I'll define what an illusion is. Illusion is a perpetual experience that does not reflect reality. We can get into a whole philosophical debate about what exactly that means. But we'll just skip that for now. Unlike a hallucination, it is not a reflection of poor health. It's not because you took drugs. An illusion will affect most people most of the time. It's something that's common between people. It's not abnormal. It affects everybody. And just to give you an example of this picture here, most people perceive A and B as being different shades of gray. They are, in fact, the same shade of gray. If you were to crop this image and put those two tiles next to each other, they would be the same color. But presumably, everybody sees two different shades of gray, am I right? Mm-hmm. So it affects everybody, unless you all dropped acid before walking in here. I think that's fair. It doesn't necessarily affect everybody, but it's more common than not. So the first one I want to talk about is called the cutaneous rabbit illusion. And this is a kind of an interesting one. And before I get into this and you all try it, it actually requires something quite rapid. So I don't know if you can replicate it here. But back in the, I think, 70s, a lot of this is from the 70s when I think about it, they discovered that this particular sequence of taps creates the illusion that it's a sequence of sequential taps going up the arm, equally spaced. Rather than being taps in one position, taps in a second, and then multiple taps in a third, it's perceived as a series going all the way up the arm. Now this is particularly interesting because it's not just a misinterpretation of the latter taps. The person actually receives the first taps as being sequential and moving up the arm, but only if followed by the latter taps. So that means that the brain, for some reason, even without feeling the latter taps, it knows somehow that it's going to move up the arm. So it almost creates the illusion before the illusion occurs. So the circumstances which create the illusion, you know, you would think that the first taps you would feel in the same spot and then it would be created later by the second series. But initially, it feels that way. And what this kind of shows is that the way our mind integrates our perceived reality, it doesn't just take everything right as it comes. It actually takes multiple experiences that are closely spaced in time and integrates them into a single perceptual experience. So your mind isn't really interpreting the stimulus. Your mind isn't really interpreting the stimulus until you've sort of received all of it. I just thought that was kind of cool. And this is kind of just what I said. It's they're not interpreted independently. Multiple sensations are integrated to a single perceptual concept, at least some of the time. Future stimuli can affect the way previous stimuli are interpreted, especially within a small time frame. Another example I wanted to show you guys was an extension of this. Is they did this experiment where they did the taps on two fingers, and then had a metal bar in between those two fingers. And people actually reported the skipping sensation moving between their fingers. So they actually felt the sensation outside of their own body, or at least perceived it that way. Yeah. I have a publication, I'll give it to you. And it's kind of a complicated experiment. It would take me 30 minutes just to explain all of it. But the basic conclusion was this, is that you can kind of coax the rabbit outside of the body. And you can convince people that they're feeling something where they don't actually feel it. And they've done this in other situations too. I don't have a slide on this, but there's something called the rubber hand experiment. Now, how many of you have heard of that? They did this experiment where they set up a person. It's been done multiple ways. But they'll have a box here, and they'll have their actual hand under the box, so that they can't see their hand. And there's a rubber replica sitting on top. And they will synchronously touch the hand in both locations on the top and the rubber hand at the same time. And they found that if the person puts their hand here, and after priming the person, doing that synchronous stimulus, the person will slowly report the sensation is coming further and further towards the rubber hand, to the point where they're reporting the stimulus is coming from the rubber hand, even though their hand isn't located underneath the rubber hand. So all this really has to do with is the way that our mind perceives a location of stimulus. The actual stimulus is coming from the hand, but we don't necessarily have an understanding of the way we gauge distances in the body. And this has to do with self-perception. I mean, if you close your eyes, you know, you don't necessarily know exactly where all of your body parts are so specifically that you can know exactly where those sensations are coming from, especially when you kind of manipulate and prime people this way. So, and it makes sense too that if you're feeling something, you can actually see where the stimulus is coming from, that you know you wouldn't necessarily point at the exact spot that it occurred, because part of how we know the way that our body is interacting with our environment where stimulus is coming from isn't just through tactile sensation. Our eyes play a role in determining that as well. I forget what the word is. It's something like proprioception or something like that.
Proprioception,
that's the one. So multiple senses are interacting to give that impression. And then the last one I came across that I found particularly interesting is called body swapping. And this is the illusion they've basically gotten you to sensory input through an entirely different body other than your own, sort of convincing you that you're in another person's body. And I'll show you the way that experiment was set up. They create this camera system so that you're looking through the camera and you see what the mannequin sees. And they prime this, they do a synchronous stimulation. They rub your belly and the mannequin's belly at the same time and you're seeing the mannequin. Later on in the experiment, I didn't have a picture of this, they actually took a knife and they stabbed the mannequin while the camera was on. And they measured the stress level of the participant in various ways, like organic stimulus response, and it skyrockets. Because you recondition the mind to perceive these stimulus in a different way. The fact that you perceive them at all is interesting, because they get to the point where they don't require synchronous stimulation. You kind of feel it even when they're not doing it to you. It's just something you're doing. But only if they do the synchronous first. And that just goes to show that it's not just the stimulation. Your mind plays a role in determining what you feel or don't feel. It plays a role.
So ever since taking Introduction to Philosophy years and years ago, I developed an interest in epistemology, this idea of what is our ability to know if we know. And ever since then, I've sort of collected these situations in which we can fool ourselves through observation. In this particular presentation, I wanted to share some tactile illusions, illusions of the sense of touch, and how they kind of play into our role of self-perception, how we see ourselves within our environment. I don't mean self-perception in the idea of, you know, how do we see ourselves, but how do we assess our position in our environment as far as the way we interact with it. And what these tactile illusions basically demonstrate is not only that we can feel things that aren't actually there, we can actually feel them in places that we aren't. We can convince people that they're feeling something in a location that doesn't even correspond to their body. And it's just a demonstration of that our senses aren't a literal interpretation of reality. We have subconscious and conscious expectations, and our sensory organs are actually designed, or I don't want to say designed, it's a dangerous word. I usually try to avoid it, but you know, I think most people know what I mean when I say designed. They've developed to see the world in a practical way. To our sensory organs, it's not necessarily important. In the way we perceive, it's not necessarily important that we see things accurately, only that we see them usefully. So that in most situations we get by. So it's just one of those things where you have to make sure, and I think if you're interested in discerning reality from what's not real, you have to be aware of the role that your perception plays in deceiving you.
While I was listening to you talk about that, it brought to mind people who say they've experienced God in one way or another. Like, I remember talking to this one guy, and we were having a civil, friendly conversation, and the conversation turned to why he believes what he believes, and he said it wasn't based on any kind of science. He said it was based on the fact that Jesus physically appeared, like as real as you know, you and I are here talking, and Jesus like pushed him across the room or something like that, and then that's why he believes. And then that got me to thinking, we go about the world and we assume that what we're seeing and what we're hearing and what we're feeling is completely rooted in reality. It's completely objective. It's all real and everything. But of course, you can be put in these situations. Like, I've taken LSD and I've seen trees dance. I obviously don't think the trees really fucking dance, you know, and you get real drunk, you see the room spinning. And then the demonstrations that you talked about, I mean, these were people who were, you know, completely sober, ostensibly not under any kind of influence, and they were still being deceived in just these kind of very simple ways. Mm-hmm. Do you think that, well, I'm not going to ask you if you think that's what's going on with like people who see Jesus. Well, I am going to ask you.
I think there's multiple things at play. I think the possibility that people believe so strongly that they can cause themselves to see and feel things that don't exist is possible. I think in that case, the more likely factor, assuming that they're sober and of sound mind at the time, is they're really probably just manipulating their own memories, convincing themselves that something was more vivid and real than it actually was. That would be my opinion about it. I mean, as for the guy who said he saw Jesus, who appeared and pushed him, I mean, my first question would be, well, was he wearing a name tag? How do you know?
He showed up and was like, I'm Jesus, push.
But yeah, it's, I think there are a lot of ways that we deceive ourselves. And the way we see our memories is one of those. Our memories change over time, and our memories, as much as our perception is not necessarily representative of reality, our memories aren't necessarily representative of the past. I think it really depends on the situation of which one of those two factors might be the strongest.
There's a good quote from Neil deGrasse Tyson. I don't remember the exact quote, but he was talking about memory, and he said, you know, in a court of law, for some reason, a eyewitness is one, you know, one of the highest forms of evidence. But in science, it's one of the lowest. Why is that? Yeah. You know, but he's right in that sense. It's one of those eyewitness accounts. It's like, cool, I can make up stuff too.
Yeah.
I think it makes perfect sense because really science is just a method of eliminating bias in observation. All of the controls and rigorous aspects of science have to do with trying to eliminate the chaos from our observation, anything that might skew our results, including the way in which we observe.
Cool chance to talk about something I read in a few different books that has sort of struck me slowly again and again as becoming a skeptic is how constructive our worldview is. That it's not, we're obviously not a video camera. That's the phrase that everyone uses. We're not a video camera. Mm-hmm. That's not how our memory works. Mm-hmm. That's not how our perceptions work.
If anyone listens to Radiolab out there, there's an episode on memory. It was talking about how our memories aren't like files in a computer,
yeah,
where you can just pull them up and bam, there they are. It's same as always. It's like every time you pull them up, it changes just a little bit, you know, and they're kind of malleable, which is interesting because then I start thinking about like my first kiss that I had in high school or something, or like my first love or something. And I'm like, well, did that go down?
Yeah,
like I thought it did. Because I've thought about it so many fucking times, you know?
Well, they talk about, like, I just got finished with The Invisible Gorilla, which is an incredible book, which I extremely recommend, by the way. And one of the things they talk about is essentially just false memories and memories that you've completely constructed. And the idea that our memories mold to fit the moral, essentially. They're like fairy tales. They mold to fit what lesson we learn from them. It makes me think that maybe high school wasn't as much bullshit as I thought it was. Maybe I had a good time. Who knows? But I thought that was a really interesting idea he had on those concepts. He had some cool different sort of psych experiments that he was going on with about not even memory, but perception. He was talking about the one with the hand. He was talking about just a few different ones where our perception can be so misleading, which is obviously to a skeptic so important because it's the skeptical toolkit, is knowing how and why and when and under what circumstances our memories and our understanding of the empirical world tend to be misleading, which is almost always.
All right. Well, thanks everyone for tuning in. That is our last Skeptic Camp episode.
Excellent. Excellent. We are finished.
So join us next time, and we speak to my old biochemistry professor, Dr. Aaron Shoulders, who's actually a devout Christian, and he doesn't accept evolution. So that will be very interesting. I'm Seth.
I'm Jeff.
We're leaders in free thought.